manifold abilities. He studied history at Oxford, and after being awarded a Harkness Fellowship, went on to take an MSc in Management Science at Stanford Graduate School. He then started his career in the Foreign Office in 1973 and worked as private secretary to the British ambassador in Paris from 1974 to 1976. He then moved to the Treasury and he became the principal handling monetary policy. From there, from 1982 to 1987, he went to the private sector working for McKinsey and Company, the management consultants, but was seconded back to the Treasury as special advisor to Nigel Lawson, then the then Chancellor of the Exchequer. After that, he spent 5 years as Controller, the Chief Executive of the Audit Commission, and then 3 years as Director General of the CBI. Now, if you are beginning to be just a tiny bit envious of the Deputy Governor and his remarkable career, I can reveal that he has also had his sadnesses and worries. In particular, he is an ardent supporter of Manchester City Football Club. And you know what has happened to them in the course of the last 2 years. Now, finally, he has said that after his lecture, he will be prepared to take questions. And that is a bonus for us all. But as the deputy knows well, bonuses can be very risky unless they are adequately structured. The Deputy Governor.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much, Charles, for that introduction. You will, those of you who read the newspapers, know that I must be extremely polite to Charles Goodhart these days, because the Sunday papers tell us that he is shortly to return to the old lady as a member of its newfangled Monetary Policy Committee. Well, I have to say it would be nice to have him back. We first met in, I think, 1979, when I was in the Treasury on Monetary Policy, and Charles was the bank's guru on Sterling M3, if you can remember that. And we lived through the sadomonetarist phase of policy together. Now the Observer wants to thrust that successful team back in place. It shows just what New Labour really means. Now, central bankers are famous for their obsessive concern with credibility and consistency. And by that token, I should clearly be drummed out of the club I have only recently joined. Because when the governor stood here at the LSE just over a year ago, he assured the audience that he was delivering the fourth and last in the series of LSE Bank of England lectures. But in keeping with the usual practice of successful TV shows, I'm here tonight to open a new series. The LSE seem to think you would prefer that to filling the schedule hereafter with repeats. Now, the new series does pick up where the last left off. In 96, the governor noted that there is nowadays a broad consensus that the raison d'etre of central banks everywhere is the pursuit of monetary and financial stability. But he observed that once you go beyond that level of generality, each central bank is unique in terms of its constitutional position, the range of its activities, its size, structure, and organisation. Many of these differences are the result of history. The question I plan to address tonight is whether contemporary forces are eroding these distinctions between central banks and pushing them towards some common model. Now, I shall confine myself largely to what is happening in Europe. The increasing globalization of financial markets is one pressure for change, which is relevant everywhere. But in Western Europe, the Maastricht Treaty and the preparations for EMU are requiring central banks to review their statutes and to align their operating procedures with each other. But I also want to talk about the central banks of Eastern Europe. They are feeling similar pressure. Several hope that their countries will accede to the EU within the next few years, but the origins are very different. In 1989, most of the state banks of Central and Eastern Europe inevitably had little understanding of the role of a central bank in a market economy. Since then, they have rapidly built up the knowledge and skills needed to tackle acute inflationary pressures, while many of their leading banks were effectively bankrupt. The Bank of England, we've been actively involved in helping them by drawing on our own experience as central bankers, adapting the lessons we've learned over the years to the unique circumstances of the transition economies. Much of that effort has been channeled through our own Centre for Central Banking Studies, which we established in 1990 to give technical assistance and training to other central banks. We've advised on the core functions of monetary policy, development of money markets and payment systems, but also on the physical security of central bank buildings and their contents. And that assistance is provided through our experts visiting other central banks and by their staff coming on study visits to London. In the early years, most of this was mainly training courses, but increasingly the participants are now able to contribute to the discussion, so they're now learning not only from our own experience as central bankers, but also from each other. And in some instances, their experience may well hold lessons for us. It is always interesting to watch people constructing new public sector institutions. Since 1990, over 4,000 staff of other central banks have participated in these courses. The work of the centre and the other interbank links we maintain give us, I believe, a privileged position, perspective on the development of central banking across Europe. And the analysis below on the developments in Eastern Europe is largely the work of Lionel Price, the centre's director, and his staff. Now, in a study published by the LSE Financial Markets Group last year, Rosa Maria Lastra concludes that central banks are not natural products, but products of history. She emphasises the special relationships whereby central banks have been consciously awarded privileges by governments and have been expected to provide certain services and functions in return. This may seem a dubious set of transactions, like selling licences to print money, something which is now mainly done, however, in the railway industry rather than central banking. But central banking, Lastra kindly says, is not an evil, which comes as a relief to some of us. Though a product of history and a creature favoured by the state, a central bank may serve useful economic goals in the pursuit of stable money and sound banking. While most of their functions could be fulfilled by a different public or private institution, central banks are today typically seen as convenient instruments for the conduct of both monetary policy and banking supervision. With our existing large staff of economists and our new Monetary Policy Committee, they also will seem to be convenient vehicles for providing opportunities for employment of monetary economists, which is something which will bring joy into their otherwise drab lives. Now, I agree with Dr. Lastra's general conclusions. Moreover, central banks' differing historical origins influence not only the tasks they carry out today, but also the way in which they think and operate. The Bank of England was established 3,000 years ago, whenever it was, to lend money to the government. And though the Maastricht Treaty now prohibits any buying of British government debt by the bank in the primary market, we still manage government funding operations in an essentially agency capacity. By contrast, the origin of the Federal Reserve Banks in the States lay in the provision of a reliable nationwide payment and depository system, and that remains a central activity. While some banking supervision is carried out by the Fed, it is largely done by a myriad of other institutions, the Office of the Controller of the Currency, banking regulators in each separate state, and the FDIC. The Bundesbank, on the other hand, was set up against the background of the need to restore and maintain a stable currency. And this, together with the concomitant political independence, remain at the heart of its role. After a recent 20% devaluation of the Deutschmark, it seems rather odd, but I will pass over the Bundesbank's recent apparent enthusiasm for what they would in other circumstances have called competitive devaluation. An early strong belief in the real bills doctrine still influences the Bundesbank's views on appropriate collateral for central bank operations with the market and justifies its large branch network. Bank of France has retained more retail banking than most other modern central banks, maintaining branches in every French département, a network it's found difficult to slim down in face of local and trade union opposition. It also makes use of its branches in compiling a centrale de risque, a register of commercial bank lending, and in keeping track of the million or so individuals who have drawn bad checks. Bank of Japan is more of a medley. Its role model when it was established in 1882 was, you may be surprised to hear, the Banque Nationale de Belgique, though some aspects of English practice were also adopted. Legislation in 1942 followed the German model, particularly making the Bank of Japan subservient to the Ministry of Finance. And after the war, there was more American influence. Now, in a couple of figures, I have attempted to capture some of the distinctions between these leading central banks. Because I'm concentrating on distinctions, I have tended to omit the common tasks, such as the issuance of banknotes and acting as banker for the government, which are carried out by virtually all central banks. Now, figure one shows the UK's scores in five areas. While in figure two, I add in, for comparison, four other major central banks. I hope that is roughly visible. Mapping the distinctions is not an easy task. For instance, though in Germany, a government office, the Bundesaufsichtsamt, is responsible for banking supervision, it is central bank staff who undertake much of the day-to-day work. In France, supervision is the responsibility of the Commission Bancaire, but its secretariat is effectively part of the Banque de France, and the governor chairs it. And in Japan, the central bank closely monitors the large banks, though the responsibility for supervision formally rests with the finance ministry. Furthermore, the extent of a country's total financial regulatory effort, encompassed by the term banking supervision, rather varies. Most British banks have set up separate subsidiaries for their trading activity, regulated by securities regulators. By contrast, European banks tend to retain trading within the banking entity. It's also not always apparent whether the central bank is in practice free to set interest rates to achieve the monetary policy objectives which derive from its own statutes or from objectives set by government. The Bundesbank clearly has that freedom, and the other EU member states have been legislating in accordance with the Maastricht Treaty to give their central banks independence in monetary policy. In Britain, even though there have been very welcome improvements in the transparency of monetary policy formulation since 1992, decisions on interest rates remain clearly with the Chancellor of the Exchequer, though now within a clear inflation target framework. And the Chancellor, certainly this Chancellor, always knows what he wants, what he really, really wants. In Japan, and it's rarely what we really, really want at the moment, but in Japan, the position is under review. The ultimate authority on interest rates has rested legally with the Minister of Finance, though according to Goodhart Capian Schnatt, than whom no higher authority can be imagined, it is widely understood that it would be extraordinary if the government resorted to these provisions and they have never been enacted. The same authors conclude that the Bank of Japan has thus enjoyed independence in practice. What is harder to judge is the extent to which its decisions may have been influenced at times by recognition of the latent ministerial powers. Notwithstanding these nuances, what can be seen from Figure 2 is that the Bank of England is quite distinctive amongst the five leading industrial countries. We had the least independence in setting interest rates. I had rather hoped for a chorus of shame at that point. We have the most comprehensive responsibility for banking supervision. Rather hoped I wouldn't hear a chorus of shame at that point. And we have the greatest role in managing government debt. We provide substantial policy input as well as actually handling auctions as issuing agent for the Treasury. We have the smallest branch network. We've consciously reduced the scope of our private banking activities in recent years, focusing on areas of comparative advantage as a public sector institution. And we're also now leaving note distribution to be handled largely by the private banks. In fact, we still do offer a full service to our personal customers, of whom there are still a few. We still have two cash machines, one in Threadneedle Street and the other in the printing works in Essex, which is a kind of factory outlet. We've indeed been considering, given the new enthusiasm of the clearing banks, for alliances with food retailers, with NatWest and Tesco and Sainsbury's Bank of Scotland, whether we should not, in fact, as the Bank of England, ally with a food retailer whose image would be similar to our own in terms of the clientele. And we are beginning to approach Fortnum's about the possibility of a Bank of England desk there. We have a comparatively limited but increasing role on the fifth axis in the southwestern corner, the operation of payment and settlement systems. Typically, the Bank of England participates in payment systems which are run by the private sector and has only involved itself in the establishment and operation of settlement systems when the private sector has not itself succeeded in doing so. Recently, however, the introduction of CREST and RTGS and the European work on TARGET, the European Real-Time Gross Settlement System, has expanded our work considerably. Now, these maps cannot easily convey a sense of the dynamics of change in central banking. Central banks are evolving creatures which respond to political and economic forces around them. One unusually powerful force which may change their habitat fundamentally is emu. But before considering its impact, I would like to refer briefly to the state of play in the rest of non-EU Europe, where exciting transformations of a different kind have occurred in the last decade. This is a development we focus less attention on here, preoccupied as we are with whether our chances of first wave emu entry are extremely unlikely, Kenneth Clark, or vanishingly small, Stephen Dorrock. Now, the central banks of the formerly planned economies of Central and Eastern Europe have generally developed important responsibilities in each of my five areas. And here I show Hungary, Poland, Slovenia, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia. The old state banks have been transformed to fill the vacuum left by the dissolution of the mechanisms and institutions of a planned economy. Most had extensive branch networks and already operated rudimentary payment systems, though transfers often relied on correspondent banking relationships and slow and unreliable postal systems. But under the old regime, there was little, if any, requirement for the other functions, setting interest rates, managing government debt, and supervising banks. Instead, the main roles of the state banks had been the provision of banknotes and making the financial transfers between state enterprises inherent in the central economic plans. The perceived importance of cash and the bookkeeping culture still influenced to varying degrees their successor institutions. But these banks have been hit by a series of powerful shocks. The first is the shift from centralized control of the economy to a market-based system. Instead of directing money to meet enterprises' deficits, a job which required a large branch network and hordes of bureaucrats, the aim is to influence the behavior of the economy using indirect instruments of monetary policy. But many of the bureaucrats find it difficult to work out which bits of information they need and how often, and prefer instead to demand a substantial volume of data without prioritization. Some of the staff of Eastern European central banks, used to passing on raw data which can be checked against enterprises' targets, find it difficult to analyze information with the aim of learning something about the behavior of markets, consumers, or firms. The second culture shock has been the move from a monobank to a two-tier banking system. The old system had two separate monetary circuits, one for cash, used mainly by individuals, and the other in transfers between bank accounts used by enterprises. One of the early tasks of Western advisors was to try to convince the would-be central bankers in the East that monetary policy was not just a matter of regulating the supply of banknotes. And many of the same people found it difficult to accept that the provision of credit by a central bank, whether to government or to enterprises, is likely to have inflationary consequences. When the basic problem is a shortage of national savings, the central bank cannot magically create extra real resources by relaxing monetary policy. Were it so, we central bankers would be even more popular people than we are now. The response of the Eastern European and Commonwealth of Independent States central banks to their new goals has been tempered by a number of factors: how long the old culture had prevailed, how democratic the new regime is — independent central banks do not get on well with autocracies — the size of the country, the availability of foreign currency to the government, and in the case of the 10 applicants, there indeed are now 10 applicants from the region to join the EU, how quickly they believe they need to move into line. The differences between these central banks are perhaps most marked in relation to monetary policy and financial relations with the government. The westernmost countries have typically liberalized the most, adopting policies and structures which are close to those of their EU neighbours. While further east, reform and market-based operations are still viewed with some scepticism, and the markets that have been introduced are subject to discretionary administrative controls, particularly in crises. Partly because of the influence of Western advisers, and in the case of EU applicants, the need to harmonise with EU law and practice, the legislation governing the new central banks usually follows a common model, giving them autonomy to pursue an objective of monetary stability. What is interesting is that the aspects of monetary control whose merits we debate in the West — the degree of independence of the central bank, inflation targets versus monetary targets, fixed or floating exchange rates — have in terms of results been of secondary importance to the understanding and acceptance of the case for reform on the part of the public, parliament and government. There's little benefit to a central bank in being independent of government if the parliament is able to force it to grant subsidised credits to favoured sectors. And independence counts for little if the government persists in running a deficit while non-monetary means to finance it have yet been developed. All of these pressures, then, have been the same on each of these central banks, but just as Kenneth Clark said the other day, you can clone sheep, but not chancellors. Whether this was a reference to Dolly or to one of his distinguished predecessors was unclear. But certainly you cannot clone central banks. And if we look at five of the central European countries where reform is most advanced, the Czech and Slovak Republics, Slovenia, Hungary and Poland, the first two have succeeded in bringing annual inflation down to single figures, while inflation in Hungary is still only just below 20%. All except Hungary monitor an intermediate monetary target, but these targets have proved unreliable friends. It's been far from easy to predict the velocity of money when the economic and financial structure is in turmoil. The more important success factor appears to have been exchange rate policy. The Czechs and Slovaks have been able to hold their exchange rates fixed against a Deutschmark US dollar basket. This has not been sufficient to deliver inflation rates of 1 to 3% in Germany, the United States, or here, as the transition economies are experiencing faster rates of growth in productivity and tradables. They need to permit their currencies to appreciate if they are to lower their inflation rates further. But their fixed exchange rates have cemented and enhanced the credibility of the sound monetary and budgetary policies being followed. Yet fixing the exchange rate is not the only route to lowering inflation. Slovenia has succeeded with a managed float, though a key factor has been its willingness to keep the real exchange rate relatively high. In contrast, Hungary and Poland have tried to prevent the inevitable real appreciation of their currencies by continually depreciating their nominal exchange rates in reflection of their high rates of inflation. Polish policy became less accommodating last year, and Hungary may well follow. Of course, an exchange rate peg is far more credible if a country has sizable foreign exchange reserves. The Baltics were fortunate in this respect as they regained access to gold held by their central banks in London and Paris before the war. And Estonia and Lithuania have gone as far as to fix their exchange rates rigidly in a currency board system which removes discretion from monetary policy. The IMF is now encouraging Bulgaria to follow suit and adopt a currency board, as the central bank there has not been able to impose sufficiently tight monetary policy in the face of lack of progress on other aspects of reform. But the currency board can only succeed as part of a comprehensive package of fiscal and structural measures. The strict monetary policy rules of a currency board can work well if the fiscal policy is highly responsible, or will become so as a result of the currency board. If not, it may put severe strains on the banking system, as has been the case in the Baltic states. Now, this potential conflict between monetary policy and maintaining the stability of the banking system is not one which has greatly troubled most Western industrial countries in recent years, though Charles Goodhart and others have debated the conditions in which a conflict may arise. But in some transitional economies, such conflicts have been very real. In most, the problem has not been so much to maintain the stability of the banking system as to create a robust system from a number of often insolvent state-owned banks spun off from the old monobank, together with newly created commercial banks whose behaviour has frequently been far from prudent, if only we tell them that they would follow the example of our own super cautious clearers. You wouldn't catch the National Westminster Bank doing what some of these Eastern European banks have done in recent years. In contrast to the diverse arrangements in the West, banking supervision in transition economies is nearly always the responsibility of the central bank. An exception is Hungary, where responsibilities have been transferred to the State Banking Supervision Office. In most of the countries, especially in those with hopes of joining the EU soon, banking legislation approximating to Western standards is or is about to be in place. But in practice, banking supervision has proved a difficult topic to master. Whereas monetary policy requires a highly trained but nonetheless quite small cadre of economists in the head office, large numbers of supervisors are needed, often spread across the country, to deal with a multitude of new banks with poor quality accounts. And the skills of assessing risk and the quality of management have not always come easily to staff from a bookkeeping background. Staff who have acquired the skills needed have frequently been enticed away to work for commercial banks at higher salaries. It's a problem we face in London too, though perhaps not to the same extent. There are some non-pecuniary benefits to working in the Bank of England. We have the best claret cellar outside Oxford. Another field in which central and Eastern European central banks are generally more heavily involved than their Western counterparts is in the management of government debt. Hungary, where there's a separate debt office under the Ministry of Finance broadly on the Irish model, is again an exception. Under the old regimes, governments relied on their state banks for finance, but the new statutes of the central banks limit the provision of finance to government. Ceilings are mostly around 5% of government revenues, sometimes less. With monetary financing restricted, new methods of financing governments have had to be developed, and nearly all the central banks have taken a leading part in that process. Even when the government's own financing needs have been small, as in the Czech Republic, central banks have been keen to establish markets in short-term paper in which they can conduct monetary operations. Whether the market being developed is in government, central bank, or private paper, the central banks have had to strike a difficult balance in deciding how frequently to intervene in the markets. In the absence of intervention, a market can remain illiquid, but if the central bank intervenes too much, then private market makers will not develop. This dilemma, of course, is not unique to transition countries, arises elsewhere too. One area of activity in which the new central banks do mirror the diversity of their Western counterparts is in responsibility for payment and settlement systems. Of the 9 central banks in Central and Eastern Europe, 5 operate the main clearing system themselves. In the other 4, the position is roughly as it is here. In Russia, the central bank has been slow to develop its own payment system, and commercial banks have been putting parallel mechanisms in place. In the West, technological developments and a desire to reduce systemic risk have been drawing central banks like ourselves into greater involvement in payment and settlement services, especially in the provision of real-time gross settlement. No doubt the central banks in the transition economies will feel the same pressures before long. On the last of my 5 metrics of central bank functions, the size of the branch network, which I use as a convenient proxy for the extent of their involvement in straight banking activities and in note distribution, the transition central banks occupy an intermediate position. The extensive branch networks of the monobanks went largely to the savings banks, and in some cases they've been turned into commercial banks. The result has been surprisingly consistent across Central and Eastern Europe, with one branch remaining for every 500,000 to 1 million people, except for the Bank of Estonia, which has no branches, a very scrupulous qualification. Which Eastern European central bank has no branches is the kind of question which can divert any London dinner party, I find. Some of the new central banks are even now questioning, as we've done, whether they need branches as distinct from regional economic intelligence agencies at all. Indeed, the Hungarian central bank has closed more than half its branches already. Obviously, the political structure and geography of the country is material. In the US and Germany, the maintenance of a branch network reflects the federal structure. In Russia, the central bank has 60 territorial branches and 19 regional banks, apparently rather modest numbers for a country with 150 million people spread across 10 time zones. But in addition, the Central Bank of Russia ran 1,356 cash centres, 13 banking schools, and 30 other organisations. To run this empire, the bank employed over 52,000 staff, having created over 7,000 additional jobs in the previous 2 years to conduct its various new functions. All of this shows that even though all central banks face similar pressures, the solutions remain quite diverse. And that is reflected in relative costs. Comparable data are hard to come by. Central banks like, for obvious reasons, to clothe their costs in decent obscurity. But the Bank of Russia appears to have more staff per head of population than any other. The People's Bank of China is larger, employing some 150,000 people, but only 1,000 in head office where policy is centralised. But considering its continuing role as banker to the state-owned enterprises, that looks quite modest in relation to a population of 1.2 billion. Other very large central banks are the Reserve Bank of India with 32,000, the US Federal Reserve System with 25,000. Now, what drives these relative costs and what is happening to costs in Europe? One would expect the number of staff employed by a central bank to depend not just on the population of the country, where there should be some economies of scale, but also on the range of tasks it has, and how efficiently it conducts them. At the bank, we've been taking a lot of interest recently in comparative efficiency. We are determined to be a value-for-money central bank, and we benchmark ourselves against others where possible. Some of the data we use are confidential. Central banks are more candid with each other in private than they are in public. But there are some published measures. A 95 study by Fry, Goodhart, and Almeida of a sample of 30 central banks, largely from developing countries, tested 12 variables as possible explanations of staff numbers. Most significant was population, with an elasticity of 0.5, confirming substantial economies of scale. And there were positive relationships with real per capita income. Central banking appears to be a luxury good. The number of branches and the use of exchange controls, both of which, of course, increase staff needs. Perhaps surprisingly, the more independent they were, the fewer staff central banks tended to employ. Perhaps that could be the basis of an accommodation with Gordon Brown. Amongst the variables which showed no relationship was the exchange rate, was the inflation rate, though there could be a simultaneity problem there. Now, figure four shows a summary of this and shows the numbers of staff employed 2 or 3 years ago by the central banks of various industrial countries and some of the transition economies. There is clearly the expected positive relationship with population, but the ratio varies hugely. A central bank on the highest of the two of the three lines has 10 times the staff per million population as the one on the lowest line. The extent of this dispersion is perhaps more apparent in this figure, which shows more simply the numbers of central bank staff per million population. With only around 3,500 people, down by more than 50% over the last 20 years and still falling fast, the Bank of England is one of the most modestly staffed in relation to its population. But in fact, regression analysis on the industrial country data shows only weak economies of scale, nor did other variables tested on industrial countries yield any significant results. As for the transition economies, their staff numbers generally conform to those in industrial countries with similar populations. The exception is the Bank of Russia, who, as I've mentioned, whose staff looks abnormally large. Now, these variations in staff numbers naturally have an impact on the running costs of central banks, though relative salary levels and other costs are also important. This figure is based on data for 92 taken from central banks' annual reports, with population across the bottom and costs as a percentage of GDP up the side. For a swathe of countries across the bottom, from New Zealand at 0.06 through Sweden, Denmark, Switzerland, the Netherlands and Australia, all were between 0.04 and 0.05, to Britain at 0.037, and Canada and the United States a little lower, there may be some scale effect. But several European countries clearly do not fit this model at all. The central banks of Italy and France, countries with the same population as the UK, then cost 5 and 3.5 times more than us, and the picture has changed little since. Some of the differences may be down to national culture, but another factor may be that the funds at the disposal of the different central banks vary widely. In particular, I expect that some of our relative cheapness may be attributable to the fact that since the Bank Charter Act of 1844, seigniorage on our banknote issue has been passed directly and immediately to the government. This is not generally the case abroad, at least in European countries, where profits, a fraction of seigniorage, are passed only periodically to the government. UK is also unusual in that foreign exchange reserves and any profits earned on them belong to the government rather than the central bank, although, of course, we do have responsibility for managing them. This seigniorage point is particularly interesting in relation to the future funding of the European Central Bank. The treaty is quite clear that members of the Eurozone will get a proportion of seigniorage income in relation to their share of GDP. In fact, currently, our seigniorage income is considerably lower, since in relation to our GDP, we use far fewer notes than do the Germans. If this provision of the treaty is carried out to the letter, there could be a very large monetary gain for the UK, perhaps around £1 billion a year. Looking at the European continent as a whole, it is interesting that whereas the common history of Central and Eastern European countries over the last half century has produced broadly similar central banks in the different countries, at least in those which are contemplating accession to the EU, the central banks of the existing member states are a far more disparate bunch. What remains to be seen is how far the advent of economic and monetary union may induce more homogeneity and indeed reduce costs. It ought to be the case, after all, that one monetary policy is cheaper to administer than 15 or indeed 25. The European Central Bank itself will appear a much more concentrated creature than the central banks we've been looking at. It will be responsible for the issuance of euro banknotes, known to the cognoscenti now as bridging finance. Curiously, this cost reduction may not be the case with the notes. It's only just occurred to us at the bank that in the eurozone, if there are seven denominations of notes, And that is what has been agreed by the European Central Bank, 5, 10, 20, 50, 100, 200 and 500, to cope with the fact that different countries have different habits in note handling, with some requiring more small denomination notes and others, notably the Germans and the Dutch, enjoying large denomination notes. That compromises that there will be 7 denominations as opposed, of course, to 4 that we have here. Also, if there is a national feature on the reverse side of each of these notes, it is clear that there will in future, in a single European currency zone, be 105 notes of different sorts circulating. This, of course, compares with 4 circulating in the United Kingdom at the moment and is larger than the total of different notes circulating in the current 15 countries. This is quite an odd feature, it would seem to me, of a single currency. One other curious feature of Europe's circulation of notes is that Europe is, as has been described to me, gravity-fed with notes. In other words, notes tend to begin their lives in Northern Europe and gradually during the year drift to the south. And that is likely to be more the case in a single currency zone where people's use of travellers' checks within Europe is highly likely to diminish. And both the Greeks and the Spaniards have realised that, technically speaking, there will be no reason whatsoever for them ever to print a note, since they will be perfectly adequately supplied from tourists coming from elsewhere in the European Union. The Greek and Spanish printing unions have become aware of this interesting point and have argued that euro notes coming from Germany should therefore be repatriated, which would be a wonderful way to begin a single currency union. But beyond the notes, about which I can talk for hours, in terms of the diagram I've been using, the European Central Bank, the red line in the centre, or looks perhaps like a black line to you, will be almost unidimensional. It will be the strongest bank, possibly the strongest bank there has ever been in terms of its independence in interest rates. It will have a very modest involvement in the payment system at the centre, but no involvement in anything else. It will not supervise banks, not even as an agent, and it will not manage government debt. It's agreed that those functions will remain firmly with the national central banks or other relevant agencies. So I said in payment systems, it will be responsible only for the tip of the iceberg, that is, target the system which links the various national payment systems of EU member states. Now, this narrow focus is no accident. The ECB's task is to maintain monetary stability, and its design reflects that. The European system of central banks collectively will do much more, of course. Now, discussions between EU central banks on how monetary policy will operate within EMU are well advanced, and the European Monetary Institute published a report in January setting out what is agreed and what remains to be decided. In principle, the creation of the ECB in 1998 need not affect the other activities of EU central banks, whether they are in or out of the euro area, provided they do not conflict with the ECB's achievement of monetary stability. But it seems very likely that some of the activities of the national central banks, and especially those who are members of the euro area, will change character as EMU develops, if indeed it does. That is partly because questions will undoubtedly be asked about costs. One influential American commentator has recently pointed out that the total cost of the US Federal Reserve System today is well under a third of the total costs of EU central banks. On that issue, as I've demonstrated, I believe we at the Bank of England have a good story to tell. But the introduction of the euro would also have major implications for payment systems and financial markets generally, which are bound to push national central banks closer together. At the same time, functions further from the core of central banking, and especially those which could be performed as well or better by the private sector, they are likely, I think, to move out of central banks. And that is another respect in which the trend at the Bank of England recently has, I think, been consistent with what is likely to happen elsewhere in Europe. As for monetary policy, if you permit me one last quotation which should appeal to this audience, Alex Kukierman said in his extensive study of central banking, "A governor who is backed by an absolutely and relatively strong research department carries more weight vis-à-vis the Treasury and other branches of government." The same will be true within the European system of central banks. So I envisage national central banks keeping their capacity to analyse the state of their domestic economy. However, it ought to be possible over time for the INS to capture some economies of scale and to develop centres of excellence in central banks around the Union with expertise in particular areas of work. It's unlikely to make sense to have 15 and certainly not 25 teams of economists analysing the causes of changes in the velocity of Euro M4. Of course, we may not need 15 monetary policy committees either. If he believes economic and monetary union is really coming, Charles would be wise not to give up his tenured chair. But I do not wish to give the impression that EMU, even if it comes about on something roughly approaching the current timetable, will be the end of history as far as European central banking is concerned. I suspect that central banks in Europe will continue to display great diversity and will continue to evolve in different directions and at different speeds in response to the characteristics of their local habitat. What is important is that they should be responsive, learning and self-critical organisations, ready to react quickly to changing circumstances. They must also, in my view, display their accountability, perhaps more so than in the past. With the greater responsibilities which European central banks, both East and West, have assumed in recent years, comes a greater need to explain the basis on which decisions are made and to account for the resources deployed in making those decisions. That accountability here runs partly to the Treasury, who exercise financial discipline over us, partly to Parliament, whose growing interest in our affairs we welcome, and partly to the broader community. And I see this series of lectures fitting within that context. And I've been pleased this evening to have the opportunity to set out some recent reflections from within the bank on the way we exercise our functions on the people's behalf. Thank you.
That was absolutely splendid. It's also given me an idea for a new exam question. Why is a central bank like a witch's pentacle? Answer in no less than three diagrams. More seriously, that was a magnificent tour d'horizon by country and by central banking function. But the Deputy Governor has now agreed to answer questions. I understand there are some mobile mics around. If you want to ask a question, could you please raise your hand? And when you're called, could you please give your name before asking your question? Do I see any questions? You, sir.
I think I can probably be helped without the microphone. Could you say something about exchange rates and currency convertibility? Which of the Eastern European countries you mentioned have convertible currencies?
I'm not sure I can go through every single one. I mean, I think that what has been important has been the willingness of countries to declare that convertibility is where they plan to end up. And it's been those who've been able to set that as a firm context for the direction of their economic reforms who have been able to move forward most quickly. And now, of course, that has been more effective in those which have been able to maintain a fixed currency link, either through a currency board, as I've described, or through a basket. So I think it's been the direction of change that's been most influential in terms of creating a climate of confidence in the currency, and therefore which has allowed you to get towards convertibility more quickly.
Howard, would you like to say
anything?
Do I see a hand?
Yes, thank you. Michael Sansom, and
Nicholas Huron.
Thank you very much. Michael Sansom, an immature student, which means that I still have plenty to learn. I very much enjoyed the talk this evening, the lecture, and its addition of useful humour. But the speaker mentioned a number of times, Mr. Davies, that the transitional countries and the transitional banks I know we want to look forward, but do you not agree that in the previous decades, say since 1920, following the 1917 Russian Revolution, much has been bandied about socialism and communism and something different and something abhorrent and so on, much of which, of course, it was. But that in terms of banking and money, banks continued, products were not produced for people to use, to satisfy people's needs was not a purpose. Production solely for selling for profit was the era of the whole of Eastern Europe in our lifetimes. And that the transition is not something from a totally different concept of society, but an adjustment, a necessary adjustment, obviously, for the globalization of what, for want of a better term, the still the most expressive one, of capitalism, be it state capitalism or any other sort. I'd be interested to have your response.
Well, I'm sure your analysis is generally correct, but I think that the point that I was trying to make was that that transition was particularly dramatic for central banks, because the role that a central bank plays within a centrally planned economy is an extremely different one, because there what it was seen as in all of the centrally planned economies was essentially the bookkeeper and the conduit for flows of funds which were determined according to planning assumptions. Now, those planning assumptions may have been more or less effective at certain times. They delivered reasonable outcomes. At other times, they collapsed around the planner's ears. But that function, right at the core, actually directing funds, is a very different one from the function that a central bank plays in an economy, in a market economy like our own. So that while it may be possible to exaggerate the nature of the change in some aspects of the transition economies, I think in the case of central banking, it was really turning the whole function of those banks on their heads. And what they had to do was to begin again and say, well, out of this, what do we take out as the new style central bank for the future? What do we transfer to a new commercial banking environment? And what do we simply abandon as, in fact, no longer relevant to the type of market economy that we have got? And the ones who've been most successful are the ones who I think thought most clearly about that three-way split the earliest, rather than seeking to maintain a kind of monobanking, as I've characterized it, system, which became increasingly out of place in a marketplace, in a market economy. So I think it's in, when I was focusing narrow on the central banking change, which I think has been extremely dramatic given the role that they used to play.
Eight rows back.
Yeah. I think there are two dimensions to that question. One is in terms of the regulatory procedure and the regulations that are being implemented, and the other is in terms of the institutional structure. It is undoubtedly true that the regulatory environment is becoming much more similar in one European country and another. The basis of the regulation of European banks is now the second Banking Coordination Directive, and that does with underpinned by Baal capital adequacy rules, etc., does in fact mean that banking supervisors in different European countries are now talking very similar languages when they are supervising their banks. And the whole structure of the 2BCD, as it's called, regime, means that there is now a much clearer allocation of responsibilities within the EU, with a home supervisor responsible for consolidated supervision of the institution, and that home supervisor is wherever the headquarters of that supervision of that bank is. So, for example, for NatWest, it's the Bank of England. For Deutsche Morgan Grenfell, the consolidated supervisor is the Bundesaufsichtsamt through its home supervision of the of Deutsche Bank. And the other supervisors in the branches around the EU, the host supervisors, are in a clear relationship with the home. And those networks are now being built all around Europe. We think we are rather faster at building those networks. We have a strong incentive for doing, because there are a lot of things that go on in London which we supervise as host supervisors, which the banks concerned do not do anywhere else. I mean, Portuguese banks would tend to do all of their derivatives activities in London. So the Portuguese home supervisors are not terribly familiar with what they are doing in London. Therefore, the host supervisor has to take a very big role and sort of lead the home supervisor, if you like. So undoubtedly, you are right that the directives, and it's the banking coordination directives, much more than EMU, which is driving that it's not exactly consolidation, but the driving increased coordination of banking supervision across the EU. I don't think, however, that necessarily carries any implications for the institutional structure. Already you can see that this banking supervision is carried out by a different set of institutions in different countries. Still, the majority of countries, it is the central bank's responsibility to do it. In some cases, it's a kind of separately identifiable part of the central bank, like in the Commission Bancaire. In other cases, it's done entirely by a different regulatory agency, like in Denmark. But I couldn't say that there was any very clear trend which required it to all merge on one particular model. And if it were, I wouldn't be able really to tell you what that model was. And at the moment, I think what we find is important is to ensure that the regulations are interpreted in the same way, that the relationships between the supervisors are adequate and effective, rather than to focus on the institutional framework. And we find it's perfectly possible for us to work in a collaborative way with De Nederlandsche Bank, who are rather like us, and also to work in a collaborative way with the Danish Financial Services Regulator, which institutionally doesn't look anything like us, but whose people are actually talking exactly the same language in terms of interpreting the European directives.
Dr. Huang.
Central banks from the transition economy to join EMU, because one argument would be that they can borrow a good reputation from other central bank, or maybe from the European central bank. But as we know that what happened to the case of Bank of Italy, it did maybe borrow some reputation, but by joining the ERM, but eventually it left and it had to leave the ERM regime. And so maybe in the future, that if the gap between a non-reputable central bank and a reputable central bank is too large, that kind of borrowing reputation mechanism may not work. What do you think about that? What is your opinion for the future?
I think I would quarrel with your, and I think that my Italian counterparts would quarrel with your use of the word eventually, because eventually the Italians got back into the ERM, which is now where they are. I think that the Italians would say, well, yes, we were bounced out of it by unusual set of circumstances. Many of the elements of which were behind our own departure from the ERM. But the Italians, unlike the mood in the UK, were absolutely determined to get back into the ERM at the first possible opportunity, and did so last November. And in fact have traded reasonably comfortably within their band over the last 3 months, so that's not a long period. In general, however, I think that your implicit point about the dangers of seeking to acquire credibility by borrowing someone else's regime is a very important point. In that, I think there is a tendency to think, and perhaps there was something of this behind our original membership of the ERM, that in times of trouble, you cling on to another anchor and hope that that will bring you to a halt. But I think that the analogy I like to think of about the ERM was that it was a bit like throwing out the anchor, but while leaving the sails up. And it's best to get, that'll stop the boat, but it will cause one or two problems in the process. And that you need to get the sails down first. And so I think that while I would understand the motivation of the economies in the central banks in Eastern Europe to say that our inflation credibility would be strongly supported if we could join a currency mechanism which would be seen to be preparatory to joining a single currency, and that would help us get our borrowing costs down, I think that you have to show your domestic determination to control inflation before you can safely do that. Now, if you can show your domestic determination for a period, you may still be paying a higher inflation premium, so you may still get some value from joining a more credible low inflation block. And so it's certainly worth doing, but I don't think that you can do it and hope that that will solve all your problems, because the experience shows that when people have tried to do that, they have often been forced out because they didn't have the domestic discipline to stick with the anchor that they have thrown out. So we would always say, from our own experience, be a little bit careful about acquiring someone else's credibility, and because you also have to accept the disciplines involved in living with it. And if you haven't had some experience of doing that beforehand, just borrowing the regime will not help you.
Two raised hands.
Two questions, if I may, about the euro. Is it going to have transferability across frontiers like a domestic check, and perhaps like a credit card? And if so, is it a central banking job to make that happen, or is it a private sector job? And the second one is will there be monetary problems from the euro being a store of value inside and particularly outside the members, like the dollar bill is now?
Yeah. As far as the transferability of the euro is concerned across within the eurozone, it ought to be completely straightforward. It ought to be just like the dollar bill in the United States. The reason I raise my slightly curiosities about the euro is partly because I'm just rather intrigued by some of these quirks of the system, but also because it seems to me that a lot of people haven't actually yet quite understood what that really means. If we really have one currency, we ought to be completely indifferent to where that note was printed. We ought to be thinking about the printing in terms of the most cost-effective ways of doing it. We ought certainly not to be imagining that we're going to print all denominations of all euro notes in all countries with all national symbols on, because the chances of achieving the kind of quality control you would need, I speak as a sort of manufacturer at this point, is very, very small. But in principle, of euro checks. We all in central banks, and indeed out central banks, will offer euro clearing facilities in their centres. Any economic agent will be able to have a euro account as of the 1st of January 1999. And even if we're not in, we will offer the facilities for people to hold domestic euro balances and to clear domestic euro in the UK through the Bank of England. And that will be linked, that clearance system will be linked to other European systems through the target system, which is the European-wide real-time gross settlement system. So you should be able to clear a euro check through any commercial bank, through any central bank, on a ring system with the European Central Bank on the loop, but sort of watching it, really, just in the same way as a domestic check is cleared at the moment. Yes, there should be no problem with that. And your second point was?
A store
of value, yes. I think there are two dimensions to that. One is the sort of the reserve currency question. It is assumed that the euro will have a larger place in the reserves of third countries than any of the constituent currencies of the euro, or indeed probably than all of them put together. That is, if the euro is perceived to be a stable, hard currency. And it's difficult to do much analysis on that, but such analysis as has been done, talking to other countries and to private fund managers, would suggest that given the depth and breadth of euro markets, if the eurozone is a large zone, that would produce euro assets with characteristics which they would wish to hold in their portfolios, and they would wish to hold more of them than they could the sum of franc, Deutschmark, lira assets in their portfolios. So it is generally assumed, though can't be proved, that the euro is likely to be more of a reserve currency than European currencies collectively currently are for non-Europeans, particularly Americans, Japanese, etc. Now, the real enthusiasts for this will go on and say that should mean that our borrowing is cheaper because there will be more of an appetite from non-Europeans for euro debt, which will mean that on average governments will be able to fund their deficits more cheaply because they're providing assets with characteristics that are more attractive to external investors. I mean, theoretically one can see that should be the case, but how important that effect will be and whether you will ever be able to measure it is a different matter. As for the notes, I think the likelihood is that the euro will be quite attractive outside the eurozone borders. At the moment, the Deutschmark is particularly held in Poland, Hungary, Turkey. The dollar is more held in Russia. And of course, you make some money that way because you know people are giving you interest-free loans if they're holding your currency and doing transactions in it outside your currency zone. And in the case of the States, that is quite sizable. Though I think it's true to say the Federal Reserve has mixed views about it, given the usage to which many of these higher denomination bills are put in Latin America. So they are slightly ambivalent about whether the benefit of the seigniorage income offsets the cost of their drug surveillance activities. And so you could expect, I think, some modest increase in the overall seigniorage income if your currency is held overseas. But there is one further drawback, which is not insignificant, and that is the more your currency is used on the street in other countries where the people using it are not alert to its characteristics, and particularly that's true of a new currency, the more exposed you are to counterfeiting, which is not a trivial issue, because you can then find flows back of counterfeited euros, which have been happily being traded on the streets of Warsaw because people weren't terribly familiar with them, they looked okay to them, and then they feed back into Germany where they're not accepted, and this is not quite serious. So the euro will be actually a very heavily protected note in terms of its security features. And I don't think that anybody in the European central banks is really planning to design the euro for third-party use. I mean, it, you know, that would be a very much a side effect if it happened to have a kind of export market, but we certainly are not designing it in order that it should. We're not going to put it Cyrillic script on the notes to make it usable in Bulgaria.
Dr. Botero, and I think this must be the last question. If you'd like to wait till the mic comes, it's just behind you.
Yes, Elisabetta Bertero from the LSE. I wonder whether I can ask you to enlarge the topic of your talk in a way to include the Fed and to maybe possibly say something about the similarities and differences between a future European system of central banks and the current Federal Reserve System. And in particular, whether you may want to comment on one difference that seems to me quite relevant, which is that the districts in which the Fed is composed of do not coincide with the political constituencies of the member states of the US, whereas the districts in which the European system of central banks would be divided will coincide with the state, with the member states, so with the political constituencies of the European Union.
Yeah. Well, there are a number of dimensions to that question. First, I would guess it would be worth pointing out that the remit of the European Central Bank is more straightforwardly a price stability remit than the Federal Reserve's remit, which does have employment built into its statute, though people have written books about the extent to which the Federal Reserve in practice operates differently from a central bank with a price stability objective. But undoubtedly that's the first point that is worth noting. I think in terms of the way in which monetary policy decisions would be made, I think there will be quite a lot of similarities in that you will have a central monetary policy council in Frankfurt, you know, with a chairman, as it were, of no nationality or appointed centrally, and then representatives from each central bank. But you're right that the dynamics could be slightly different in that each of those each of the governors of the component central banks of the European system of central banks will exist in a much clearer, much better defined political environment. And undoubtedly, the pressures on them will be considerably stronger than the political pressures on the president of the Kansas Fed, I mean, whose constituency is, as you rightly point out, not itself very neatly politically defined. I mean, they are meant to be, they're kind of watershed defined almost in the flows of, or rather old ancestral flows of business and trade, which were meant to be coherent economic areas rather than coherent political units. So the extent to which that will affect decision making, I think, is one which is quite unpredictable at the present time. It's very hard to say how far the governors of the individual countries will be affected by political considerations. But I think that they're more likely to be affected by, you know, different cyclical conditions of their economies from which they come. And that is obviously the case if you ask yourself the question, you know, how would the discussion go around the table in Frankfurt today if we were a member of a single currency bloc meeting, and if my governor was meeting Jean-Claude Trichet and Hans Tietmeyer today and talking about interest rate policy. I mean, we know enough about the views of those three from the public prints to know that they're not exactly pointing in the same directions in terms of interest rates at the present time, and quite reasonably so given the different states of their economies. So I think the more important question is going to be the extent to which nominal convergence is translated into real economy cyclical convergence quickly, because I think the tensions are more likely to emerge if there are different cyclical patterns in the different component countries. And those cyclical patterns will, of course, be translated into political pressure on the governor of the member state concern. But, I mean, in general, I mean, it's probably ought to end with the simple point that in many ways the system will be quite similar. I mean, the way the monetary policy framework is being constructed is not dissimilar. The central bank will operate through repos. It will operate mainly on a decentralized basis in the main financial centers. And the central bank is being constructed as a relatively small operation. I mean, it has about 350 people at the moment, and even up to 1 January 1999, it shouldn't have more than 600 or 700 people at the center. It is being constructed more like the Federal Reserve System with, as it were, the board offices in Washington than it is being constructed as one all-singing, all-dancing central bank that will handle all its operations itself. So while you're right to point to the political dissimilarities, I think the architectural similarities are also important to note.
Thank you very much. Alas, we have to give way to a dance company. So it only remains for me and for you to thank the deputy for a very far-ranging and most excellent lecture and his extremely full answers to your various questions. Thank you, Mr. Deputy.